I'm Richard Hake, filling in for Leonard Lope today. Ratings agencies play a vital and supposedly somewhat boring role in our economy. Their job is to assess the soundness and safety of this or that investment and give it a grade. But recent litigation has turned up new documents and correspondence, which, according to our next guest, leave virtually no doubt that the great ratings agencies like Moody's and S&P essentially put their analysis up for sale in the years leading up to the 2008 economic crash. Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. His article, The Last Mystery of the Financial Crisis, appears in its July 4th issue, and we're pleased to welcome him back to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hey, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
So we've known for a long time that many of the major banks were able to sell financial products that were essentially junk in the years leading up to the financial crisis because the ratings those poor products were given by the companies like Moody's and S&P. Did anyone just realize how subjective this process was before 2008?
I think a lot of people had a belief that the evaluation process that that these companies went through when they were rating these instruments, they thought it was a lot more rigorous than it turned out to be. And they also thought it was less dependent upon the financial relationships that these companies had with the financial companies that made these products. And I think that's the shocking part that we're now finding out, is how closely tied the ratings were to the financial relationship of the bank that was creating the product.
You also call it the last mystery of the financial crisis.
Right. Yeah. For some reason, after the financial crisis happened in 2008, there was all sorts of investigation into the causes of the crash. But for some reason, you know, everybody blamed the banks. Lots of people blamed mortgage lenders like Countrywide, homeowners. Everybody got a slice of the blame. But the one sort of sector that didn't really get examined all that closely was the ratings agencies. Except for one Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report, there really hasn't been a lot of attention paid to it up until now.
Now, often investors will look for products with that, you know, the AAA rating.
Right.
In theory, was a AAA rating what is that supposed to mean?
A AAA rating is supposed to be credit risk almost zero. If you look at the internal documents from the companies themselves, they describe AAA as being safe enough, an investment that's safe enough to survive an event like the Great Depression. You should have one default in maybe 50,000 instances. So a AAA rating should be extremely safe. There shouldn't be really any risk of default there at all.
Now, weren't many of the mortgage-backed securities which were sold in the mid-2000s, weren't they AAA rated?
Yes, a lot of them were AAA rated, and they were based on very complicated algorithms. Most of the time, these were huge pools of mortgages. So what they would do is they would take 500 or 1,000 home loans and they would throw them into a pool. And then what they were really doing when they were assigning a rating to that pool is they were calculating how often it would happen that, say, 30% of that pool would default because they were peeling sections of that pool off and selling those as securities. But the math was all wrong. They were typically overrating or underrating the possibility of default in those home loans.
So do you have any figures? What percentage of those investments had their ratings eventually downgraded?
Well, in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, one of the things that they found out was that Moody's at one point was giving out 30 AAA ratings a day to mortgage-backed securities. And of those home loans, this was in, I think, 2006, something like 83% of them were eventually downgraded. So a huge percentage of these mortgage-backed securities were not really AAA-rated instruments.
So your article is based in large part on emails and other documents which came to light as part of a lawsuit by the firm Robbins, Geller, Rudman & Dowd against the ratings industry. Who were the plaintiffs in the case?
There were a number of sort of institutional investors. This law firm kind of scanned the planet looking for people who had lost money in these instruments, and they found there were investors in the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority or Investment Bank, I believe. There was King County, Washington was another one. There was a student loan facility in Iowa. It was really all around the planet. There were banks in Asia. And this was really representative of the problem in the financial crisis. It was the target in this game. The whole game was about taking pools of mortgages that were overrated and then sort of selling them off as quickly as possible to institutions around the world. And they typically found people who were as far away from America as they could to sell this stuff, and people didn't really know exactly what they were buying. So that was kind of reflected in this plaintiff pool.
Would this also affect, like, pensions?
Absolutely. Pensions were a typical target of these sales. And the way this usually went would be a bank would lend a gazillion dollars to a company like Countrywide. Countrywide would go out and make a whole bunch of loans to anybody with a pulse. They would then sell the loans back to the bank. The bank would chop the loans up into securities, and then as soon as they could, they would sell it to, say, a pension fund, because nobody wanted to be holding those loans. That was the whole thing. It was like a hot potato game. And yes, you're absolutely right. Pensions were a common customer in this scheme.
Moody's and S&P settled these cases for a reported $225 million. Is that a fairly large sum by financial industry standards?
I would say that it's a little on the small side. I mean, I think it's a good settlement for the plaintiffs. There have been a lot of cases in the financial crisis era that where people didn't get anything at all, so that's a good result. But I think they were probably happy that they got away with that small of a sum. Certainly, the markets reacted favorably when that sum came out, because it suggested that the companies are going to survive.
Now, you call the documents obtained by the lawsuits the black box in the American financial airplane. What kind of things do they contain? What are in those documents?
Well, the big mystery throughout this entire period was how did these instruments, these subprime mortgages belonging to people who, you know, like underemployed janitors in Fresno and all these people who, you know, didn't even have jobs or weren't even citizens, you know, how did they get $500,000 houses, and how did those these pools of their mortgages, how did they become AAA? And these documents are emails back and forth between companies like Moody's and S&P and an investment bank, Morgan Stanley, where we kind of see exactly how those AAA ratings were crafted. And the process is really pretty crude. You know, you'd have an analyst at the ratings agency who would be balking. He would be saying, no, I really can't give this that rating. And then 2 minutes later, the banker would be going above his head to some sales side guy and saying, your analyst is being uncooperative. And next thing you know, it was getting a AAA rating. So, it's all there. It's sort of the architecture of how these bad ratings happened are in these documents.
And why would they not want to give these ratings?
The analysts?
Yeah.
Because they were looking at them and sincerely understanding that they were unsafe, that the structures were bad, that they were undercapitalized. But the problem was these companies, these ratings agencies, they're paid by the companies that are making these products. So there's a conflict of interest. The sales side people in the company want the high rating because they want to keep the business to keep coming in. The analyst, who shouldn't care, is being pressured by the people within the company to give the high rating. So that's where this tension comes in, and that's what comes out in these documents is this whole, you know, intramural problem within these companies.
You quote an email by one Standard & Poor's executive who says, quote, Lord help our blanking scam, can't say that on the radio, and another who says, let's hope we are all wealthy and retired by the time this house of cards falters. Is it your sense that this kind of thinking was considered normal at the ratings agencies?
Yeah, absolutely. There were so many documents we had to leave out. We had so many emails that were like this, where you'd have an analyst saying, you know, I can't believe, you know, we have to do this, or, you know, that Lord help our bleeping scam email was actually kind of funny. That was a sales side guy who was upset that there were people inside the agency who were not letting the banks get away with everything. And what he was really doing was expressing frustration that there were still people in the company who didn't understand how the scam worked. We take the money, we give the rating, that's how it works. Mm-hmm. And that's why he was saying, you know, Lord help our effing scam. But, you know, there are hundreds of these emails that kind of express this.
So why have these documents gone largely unexamined by the media up until now?
Well, they were sort of quiet. They quietly became public last year in a kind of little observed judicial ruling. But then there was more evidence that was gathered in the year since. And then after the settlement, I think journalists just didn't pay attention to it. This is a difficult topic. It's really, really hard to fight through the jargon, and you need a lot of space to explain what it means. So unless, you know, you're a magazine that's mm-hmm. willing to devote, you know, 6,000-7,000 words to it, it's really hard to do. And I think that's one of the problems. You know, the Times did do a couple of stories about this stuff, but again, it's just a typical financial crisis story where it's a hard sell to ordinary people.
Now, is it your sense that the individuals that, you know, were quoted were deeply cynical about the financial industry as a whole, do you think? Or were they also feeling guilty about what they were doing?
I think there were some who were feeling guilty. There's one kind of poignant email in there where this one lead analyst is kind of wistfully writing to somebody else in the company saying, remember the dream of pure quantitative analysis, you know, he was sort of pining for the days when ratings agencies could actually honestly rate these products. I think that was kind of a common sentiment within these companies. I know, you know, personally, I've interviewed people for other stories who were involved with the process of, say, rating CDOs, you know, mortgage-backed instruments, and they wanted to do the right thing. They wanted to do an honest job, but the financial pressures just make it impossible for them to do that. And that's really the issue here.
So do you think that's just a part of the culture, you know, since the ratings agencies were around, or is it something that changed culturally at some point?
Well, the ratings agencies used to work on a different financial model. It used to be that everybody kind of paid a subscription to get these ratings. So indirectly, back in the 70s and the 60s, the customer was actually the investor, the person who was buying these financial products. So you'd have the pension fund. They might subscribe to Moody's or S&P. But that model changed in the last 20 years or so to this thing they call now the issuer pays model. And that's where the customer now is Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs or Bank of America, and they're paying to have their own products rated. And that's when the process got corrupted, when that revenue model changed.
Isn't it a clear, like, conflict of interest?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, he said, you know, it's like having somebody who's on trial paying the judge's salary. It's a ridiculous conflict. And what's so funny about it is that this is one of the easiest fixes that could have been made after the crash in 2008. They could have done something to clean this up and to break that conflict of interest. But this is the one thing that Dodd-Frank didn't really address, and that really hasn't been fixed on Wall Street. We still have the same corrupted system.
I'm speaking with Rolling Stone contributing editor Matt Taibbi about the role that the ratings agencies played in the 2008 financial meltdown. His article is called The Last Mystery of Financial Crisis. It appears in the July 4th issue of the magazine. We'll be back after a break. I'm Richard Hake in for Leonard Lopate. Today we're speaking with Rolling Stone contributing editor Matt Taibbi about the role that the ratings agencies played in the 2008 financial meltdown. The lawsuits that we were talking about before accused the ratings agencies of conspiring with Morgan Stanley to push investment in a pair of subprime mortgage-laden deals, and were called Cheney and Rhinebridge. How much money was involved in both of those deals? And talk about them a little bit.
They were both billion-dollar deals. What they called these things they were making, they're called SIVs, structured investment vehicles, and they're kind of like these huge off-balance sheet platforms that were full of various kinds of investments. So the ratings agencies had a difficult job. They not only had to sort of rate the underlying investments that were in the structure, like mortgages or student loans, but they also had to rate the structure itself, whether it was sound. And so it's an extraordinarily complicated mathematical job that they had to do. But the thing that was really interesting about these two deals, I think especially, was the second one, Rhinebridge, which was a billion-dollar sort of bomb of subprime that was pushed out into the market literally a week before the ratings agencies downgraded hundreds of mortgage-backed securities. So they knew that they were about to go negative on subprime massively within a week or two, and yet they pushed this thing out there with a AAA rating, which it's clearly unethical and very, very damning, I think.
Talk a little bit more about these SIVs, or structured investment vehicles. You write in the article that they operate on the same basic concept as an ordinary bank. How so?
Well, they would borrow sort of short-term cash from investors, and that would be plunged into sort of short-term investments like commercial paper, and that short-term investment would go to fund longer-term investments like mortgages or student loans. So it's the same concept as a bank, where a bank is borrowing short-term cash from depositors, and then it lends long-term in the form of business loans or whatever, except that these are not regulated like banks. These SIVs do not have capital requirements. They don't have the same regulations. And the only way that they were regulated at all was sort of indirectly by the ratings agencies, which wouldn't give them a high rating unless they were structured in a way that was safe and sound and protected investors to a certain degree. And that's what the whole rub here was. They were not doing enough of a job protecting the investors in these instruments.
And then the banks were able to push down their capital requirements, right? Through pressure?
Through pressure, yeah, exactly. In the Cheney, the first deal, the ratings agency was insisting that they have a 1% capital buffer. In other words, that there be like a certain amount of kind of hard reserves to protect investors in there. And Morgan Stanley wanted to lower that number to 0.75%. And they went kind of over the heads of the analysts and said, your analysts are being inappropriate. We want that number lowered. And literally, like that day, the ratings agency changed its mind and they got their 0.75% buffer. And that became the template for later instruments that were just like this. And that's sort of what they kept doing. They kept constantly pushing the envelope and making the analysis weaker and weaker and weaker, so that AAA meant less and less and less.
So aren't the SIVs similar to the financial instruments that was at the core of the Enron collapse?
A little bit, yeah, because they're sort of these off-balance sheet structures that technically are not controlled by, say, an investment bank like Morgan Stanley or a bank like Bank of America, but they did sort of have control over them. So it's the same concept as what happened in Enron, where they were creating these sort of independent vehicles that they actually had control of, and they were parking the losses in those vehicles, but they were technically, from an accounting standpoint, independent. And that's kind of the similar concept here with these SIVs.
So were they regulated at all or after Enron?
No, not really, no. That's another thing that's kind of gone unchanged. I mean, the SIVs, they still exist in the same, obviously not with subprime in the same way, but that hasn't changed either.
Well, when were they developed? When did they start using them?
From what I understand, it was the late 80s. There was there was some kind of rewrite of the Basel International Banking Regulations, and the banks discovered that there was sort of this little loophole that allowed them to park massive amounts of things like subprime mortgages off their own balance sheets through these vehicles. So they've existed for 25, 30 years, but they didn't really come into vogue in a big way until the early 2000s. And it wasn't until the Cheney SIV that we write about, I think that started in 2003, and that was Morgan Stanley's first one, and that was kind of the beginning of the era when all the banks kind of plunged into this particular kind of vehicle.
Now, was Morgan Stanley aware that mortgages that it was putting into the SIVs were junk, and then the borrowers were suspect?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are these incredibly comical emails back and forth between Morgan Stanley executives where they're talking about the kinds of people who are who are taking out mortgages. There's this one guy who's reviewing all these mortgage applications, and he sees that he's got like a tarot card reader who's claiming to make $15,000 a month, and you know, some other guy who claimed to have some job in a casino or something, but was claiming $20,000 in income a month with no verification. And the really interesting thing about the email is that the Morgan Stanley executive is saying, and the problem is that we're seeing what I would call a lot of people with this profile. In other words, there are a lot of kind of shady mortgage applications. And, you know, this is sort of like up the jungle. You know, they just kind of didn't care what they put in the sausages. They knew this stuff was bad. They kind of shoved it in there anyway. And they knew that the customer was going to eat it, you know, eventually anyway.
That's also the cartoon on your in the article in Rolling Stone.
Exactly.
Where did the rating agencies come into the story here with like Morgan Stanley?
Well, Morgan Stanley and a hedge fund are getting together to create this sieve, this gigantic vehicle full of subprime mortgages. They need, in order to sell it on the market, they need it to be rated highly, just because investors are not going to buy this product unless it has a certain rating. Particularly many institutional investors, they're actually required to have a certain amount of holdings that are AAA rated. And so that gives them an enormous advantage, like, you know, a double A rating or a triple B rating. It just isn't sufficient for the banks. They must have triple A in order to market this thing. And so that's why they would come to the ratings agencies, and this is a critical part of the marketing operation for getting rid of all these mortgages, was getting that AAA rating. And you know, that's what they did. They hired them to do this job. And it was kind of understood that if they didn't get the rating they wanted, that they weren't going to get any more business.
But what the thing that confuses me a little bit, couldn't the ratings agencies have just looked at those people you mentioned, those subprime borrowers, and realized that they were never going to be able to pay back their mortgages?
Sure, yeah. They could have done that, and they could have balked, and they could have said, and I think we did see this in the emails. We saw analysts who were concerned about, you know, the underlying instruments, like, you know, what the mortgages were. But they couldn't overrule their own business people. The business people wanted to do the deal. They wanted to rate these products. And the only way they could do it is if they gave them a high enough rating. And so they were overruled. That's what it was all about.
So do the documents also show that the bankers routinely pressured the ratings agents to give them what they wanted?
Yes, absolutely. We see emails from Morgan Stanley to the business people at Moody's and S&P complaining about the analysts, saying their approach is inappropriate. You know, we would like to see more cooperation, things like that. And the timeline in almost every one of these cases is they complain to the person that they're doing the deal with, and within a couple of days, the opinion of the analyst has changed, you know, or the judgment has changed. And that's the process that these lawsuits was really based around, was this idea that they were paying for analysis.
Now, hasn't it been alleged that in one case, Morgan Stanley wrote its own ratings for Moody's?
Yeah, exactly. Now, they denied this. There's an email where there's sort of a preliminary report about the Cheney investment vehicle. And one of the Morgan Stanley executives says, this report, and then he's in parentheses, he says, which we ended up writing. And so the allegation is that Morgan Stanley actually wrote a Moody's review. Now, I contacted both companies, and they both vociferously deny that anybody except Moody's wrote that report. But undeniably, it's in the email record that a Morgan Stanley executive claimed to have written it.
Mm-hmm. So you also write that when it came to Cheney, the SIV, Moody's punted some caution. In what ways did it do that?
It
went through with caution. It was not giving it the rating that maybe it did to the other ones.
I'm sorry, I don't recall that.
What about the people who were found writing these emails? I mean, has any of them been held accountable for this?
No. And that's also not unusual. Obviously, There's still a couple of shoes that you know have to drop in this whole process. There's a major civil suit. The Justice Department is suing Standard & Poor's, so there might be some kind of penalty that may yet still be incurred by S&P. But individuals in general in the financial crisis just never paid. You know, even when there was a massive settlement against this or that company. There are two things that are almost always true. Number one is that the company never had to admit or deny responsibility, and the other thing is that individuals never had to pay out of their own pockets.
Why is a civil suit and not a criminal suit?
That's part of the reason. I mean, that's usually a strategic decision by the government because they, there's a lower standard of proof. Obviously, there are criminal charges that could be contemplated here. I mean, it's all fraud essentially. This sort of fits in within the larger framework of how the government has approached the financial crisis. They have not really gone after individuals, either civilly or criminally. They've instead gone for these big financial settlements with all these companies. And it doesn't have to even be, you know, simple financial crimes like in the case of these ratings agencies, even with something like, laundering money for drug dealers like we saw with HSBC. They went after a big financial settlement and did not go after individuals. So this is totally characteristic of the way they approached the entire thing.
Now, the SEC chair, Mary Jo White, has been criticized for her closeness to the financial industry. Has she indicated where she stands on the rating agency practices?
No, not yet, no. Obviously, there have been some recent decisions that she's made about sort of ending this era of the neither admit nor deny settlements. But there's a lot of controversy in the markets over whether or not that's a sincere change or not. But clearly the SEC has not done anything yet to really change the behaviors of the ratings agencies. The only thing that's really on the table, the SEC was charged with sort of examining the problem by Congress, and they held a roundtable about it, and they've concluded that yes, there is a conflict of interest, but they haven't yet come up with a formula for ending the problem.
So are the agencies sort of like the banks? They're just too big to fail?
No, actually, the odd thing about the ratings agencies is that they aren't these financial behemoths that the world, you know, couldn't do without. I think they're absolutely small enough to fix, and they are small enough to go after. But what they have is they have very powerful patrons in the financial industry. The banks are dependent upon them in a certain way. They support them heavily. They have lobbying efforts that back them, you know, have backed them all the way through the crisis. And that's where their political leverage comes from. It's the fact that they're tied to the banks so closely.
And wouldn't they fail also if they're not trusted by the clients?
Well, that's the funny thing, is they shouldn't be trusted by the clients. I think what we've seen since 2008 is that everybody should have run screaming from these companies. But they have a kind of pseudo permanent subsidy in the sense that many banks and financial companies are required to keep certain amounts of reserves that have a AAA rating. And some of those ratings have to be from these ratings agencies. So they have a certain market share built in no matter what. And they're going to keep it until we change the system.
Okay, we've been speaking with Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi. His article is called The Last Mystery of the Financial Crisis. It's in the July 4th issue of the magazine. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Richard.